welcome. Glad to have everybody here. Glad for everything you guys do to help us. Let's start off with acceptance of the minutes and approval of the agenda. Do I have a motion to accept those?
I'll move.
I've got a motion from Craig to accept the minutes and agenda. How about a
second?
And a second from Cecilia. Any questions or comments on them? Okay, our next meeting will be November 20th.
Oh,
yes.
Sorry. Was that the agenda that you?
Yeah.
Okay. What? Oh, yeah, you haven't voted yet, right?
We need to vote. Okay, all those in favor accepting?
Aye.
Against? None, and it's unanimous. And do we have any questions or comments for management?
Have you done the minutes then?
Yeah, I put those two together.
They work together, okay.
They're grouped with those now.
I didn't.
Okay, then we'll move on to item six, to legislative update. Tim Stewart. Hello, Tim.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
So, I don't have video of you, but apparently you can see me, is that correct?
Yes.
So, I'm coming to you live from the glass enclosed event center that is 6433 Shady Lane, Ulster, Virginia. Also known as the home office of the country office. So, if there's a dog that barks or a 7-year-old that comes in and tells you all that he has an issue with something, I apologize for that. But where would you like me to start? Not much going on back here in Washington, as you might imagine. It's pretty quiet right now. Everybody's getting along great. We're just really feeling good about things. So, what I can do, Holly, is maybe just give you a quick overview of the Crib Notes version of the written outlook that we did last week for you. That should be in your minutes there, and then maybe expand a little bit more on what the prognosis is for both appropriations, but also general funding for longer term highway transit bill, and open up a question. Would that be all right?
That would be great. Thanks.
Okay. So I'm sorry to have to bore you with a little bit of a legislative primer, but we are in this 5 to 6 year cycle where we have a highway bill that is starting to move. These are usually 2-year processes. It takes about from 6 or 9 months for each the Senate and the House to move their individual versions of their bills, and then it takes another 9 months for them to get everything hashed out. What we're facing a situation now is our deadline for the authorization, which expires actually September of next year. And just to refresh your memory, when we do a transportation bill, that is primarily highways, but transit is packed in on that. And so this is an interesting scenario where the Senate has actually taken action first. They moved in late July in a very bipartisan way. They moved their bill out of committee. It authorizes a total of about $290 billion in highway funding for the next 6 years. It's always been traditionally a bipartisan bill. But the scenario that those of us who are interested in transit funding is that becomes the primary vehicle by which other committees have to then tack on their particular version. And unlike the House, in the Senate, transit authority rests actually under a different committee jurisdiction than the rest of it in the Senate, Banking, Housing, Urban Affairs Committee, rather than Environment Public Works Committee. So the EPW committee moved the highway bill, put it out there, and the next step is for Senate Banking to put their transit portion together, and then those two will be married when the bill is brought to the floor. And so it is a little bit complicated in how funding mechanisms and these two or three committees have to work together, because the third committee that really plays the role is the Finance Committee. That essentially tells the EPW and the housing, the banking committee, where they're gonna, how they're gonna be able to spend the money, where they're gonna get the money from. And so the fact that the Senate has moved first is an encouraging development, because oftentimes the Senate is the holdup. So what we saw through the summer then now pushes us in a scenario where a lot of interest groups, a lot of members of the Senate are coming to Senator McConnell and saying, we really do need to put something on the table and get moving on it. Those conversations were had yet again last week, and you're starting to see here in Washington, you're starting to see the movement to take place a little more. There's the running ads on local radio, for example, saying all the senators and people to support robust transit funding, for example. And so while the Senate is moving there, the House, on the other hand, is uncharacteristically moving slower. The chairman of the House committee, Mr. DeFazio, said just in the last day or two that they're getting their bill put together, and that we should be able to see something in see a draft in the next couple of weeks. So the result is, setting impeachment and all this other crap aside, they realize they do need to get the bill done. Now, originally the talk a year ago was we're going to do a massive $2 trillion infrastructure bill. I think the political realities and the budget realities have scaled them back from that, and they're focusing primarily on highway transportation. But all the indicators seem to be showing up that sometime in the late fall or sometime in January, February, we'll have a House bill and a Senate bill, which will then be married up. And we're assuming that the House numbers are going to come in a little bit higher than the Senate. There's still an issue as to how this is actually paid for. Everybody is really, really reticent to move forward on a fairly significant tax bill or a gas tax bill. So they're looking for a number of different budget mechanisms and gimmicks to figure out how to pay for it. One of the fun, interesting things is they're saying, well, what if we take a good hard look at user fees for electric vehicles, for example. And so transit's obviously a much smaller portion of that, but the reality is there is movement, and we're actually pretty encouraged by that. Let me hit pause real quick, and is there any questions with regards to the broad picture? And if not, then we can talk a little bit more about what the implications are and what the considerations are for the district itself and what we need to.
Any questions? No? Looks like there's no questions, Tim.
Okay. So, as I mentioned in my memo last week, our fortunes are still tied to this bill. And the timetable that's running forward is they were by April or May of next year, everything in Congress will shut down, because it's not just an election year, but it's a presidential election year. And so I think the committees recognize they have but a short time period to get a broader bill done. If not, they're going to have to pass at least a short-term extension. From the district's perspective, it being a very unique election year, everybody's signaling that there will be some opportunities to try and figure out how to in this administration with the Democratic House, how to fund some Democratic priorities. The Senate will build on that. And so we have not been told no with regards to congressional-designated funding priorities. We worked long and hard and prepared for this for a long time. And while a $2 trillion bill makes it much easier to tuck in that $25 million local project, that scenario, as ideal as it is, probably isn't going to play out, and so we're doing this within the framework of maybe a 4 or 6 year authorization process. We'll work under that scenario. We have done virtually everything we can, though we still need to do a little bit more to prepare our congressional delegation to move on that. I think we probably need to do a little bit more work with the two senators just to refresh their memory. But we have all of our House delegation lined up and supportive. They have everything they need to submit those requests when the time is right. I think this delegation is, with a little more work, like I said, with the Senate, this delegation is prepared. I think the board visits, I think Todd has done a great job in pitching the project, both in Washington and on the ground there in Logan. And we passed the red face test on virtually every single level. We economic models show, the local support shows, matching funds that are in place already or that can be produced. All of those things are just key, I think, to making us one of the most viable projects that could be submitted under this scenario. And so I may be whistling past the graveyard, but I think we're pretty well positioned at this particular point. I guess the one challenge is, now things may completely blow up back here, and they've pushed themselves into a short-term extension sometime in the middle of the summer or the early fall, just to get themselves past the election and figure out wherever they go from there. So, like I said, there's not much else going on except this little thing called impeachment politics. But I think we're pretty well positioned at this point to get a highway bill and a transit title with some money from the district. So I'll just pause there again and answer any questions.
Has anyone got any questions?
I want to know the odds of impeachment.
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you guys, I've never thought I'd reach the point in my life where I'd be so past feeling I've lost all capacity to care about just about everything with regards to politics. The odds are such the House will probably do something. They'll work through this in whatever manner they work through it, closed doors or not. They'll put up articles of impeachment. They'll send it over to the Senate, and McConnell will, despite the pressure that's being built on him, McConnell will essentially run the Senate process if forced to, and it will result in a deadlock just like it was in 1998. I think that's the ultimate scenario. The question is, how much time on the clock does that actually chew up? And the difference between this cycle and the one in 98 was, frankly, where you were in the electoral calendar. And if you recall, in 1998, you were coming into the mid-year election of President Clinton's second term. We're still 2 years ahead. There's a political case to be made, and I think a communications case to be made, that why are we trying to impeach somebody who may not be elected 9 months from now? And that's going to have an interesting impact on how the narrative fits. There are no minds to be made up or to be changed at this point. That I think everybody who is going to be casting a vote one way or the other has already made up their minds, and I don't think there's going to be any surprises.
Anything else?
But it's not a fun place to be right now. In the last week, I've been in Italy, Texas, Utah, and D.C. Frankly, I'll take any one of those other three places before where I'm at. I'll even take Logan at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night when it's freezing, going to a football game over what is
okay, anything else?
Any other questions? I don't mean to just be talking to hear the sound of my own voice, so what else can I answer for you?
Anybody have anything? I think that's it, Tim.
Okay.
Thank you
so much. Thanks for letting me call in. Happy to do this anytime you want. It's always great that I'm happy to go out every time. Like I say, in an environment like this, I'm happy to get on a plane to go back out to Logan. So we'll maybe talk live next time. How about that?
That sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay, let's see. Did I excuse Roger and Heidi? They both asked me to excuse tonight. Okay, we'll move on to number 6, legislative. We're number 7, excuse me. Presentation on how the connector routes affect short and medium transit plans.
Well, I was gonna do that, if I can get my mouse working. Okay. Just gotta push the button, sorry. All right. So I thought we would share with you. Last night, Holly and I went to the county council meeting and did this presentation at the county council meeting. And so I thought we'd do the same thing. And part of this was Glenn had asked us, as we went through the budget workshops, and thank you for those of you that came to those, we kind of talked a little bit about what this connector route does and how it pivots us for some future planning. And so Glenn had asked maybe we share some of that. And so I thought we would just come back and do that. And so some of this will be review. Some of this might be a little bit more in depth than what we've talked about. And please, if you have questions, please ask. All right, so some of the challenges specific to transit. Let me see if I can get this working. So again, over time, as we've had traffic increase, it increases the time it takes to operate the route, potential for accidents. Our sprawling communities, again, as our communities grow and they sprawl out, it's harder and harder for us to reach all aspects of the community and get things back to the transit center. Essentially what this does is it slows the routes down, it takes more time, and then again, it makes them less dependable as far as making those timed connections. And then, you know, we continue to hear from residents about increasing the convenience of overall transit. And we shared last night with the county council that the additional funding that they had passed, which we're receiving, was going towards this route. So I'll go quickly through this because we've been through this part of it. So this is the connector route. And so, you know, these are the things that it's going to do for us. We're starting in January, no transfers for 60% of the origins and destinations. We've gone through this with you. The scalability to where we can add buses, take buses off, increase or decrease frequency. So again, during the peak time, we're looking at 15 minutes, peak being from 7 to 11 in the morning and from 3 to 7 in the evening, and then connecting the university to downtown. And then this idea of establishing what we call the connector or trunk line, I think is a big thing. So essentially, well, I'll get to it when I get to that slide. And then we talked with them about how we're deploying the technology, and that's a part of this too. I think that we want to make sure that you all understand is deploying this technology, specifically with the connector route, allows us to go to a frequency-based service instead of a schedule-based service. So the fact that we now have this app and the other apps as well that allow people to see the bus in real time allows us to, instead of having a set schedule, go to frequency. The bus is coming every 15 minutes. Specifically when we're talking about running on Main Street, that's, I think, a big thing. And we hope, based on what we're anticipating, we hope that's a good thing, because the running on Main Street is a big challenge, right? So if let's say we had a schedule that the bus is going to pass a stop, you know, every 15 minutes, and it's on a set schedule. Well, during the lull in traffic, probably pretty doable. But as traffic ramps up, that probably gets pretty difficult, and then the buses run behind schedule, and people are frustrated because we have set an expectation that the bus is going to be at that stop, you know, every 15 minutes. With having the real-time app and just saying the bus is going to be by approximately every 15 minutes, now we can ebb and flow a little bit, and I don't think it's, I think people will be more forgiving because we've not set an expectation. We're saying it's approximately every 15 minutes. I had the opportunity to just watch this recently. I helped out at the pumpkin walk, and I was the guy at the pumpkin walk loading and unloading the passengers when the drivers would come in. And so we have there that we're running buses approximately every 10 minutes. Never once did I have anyone complain, and it was pouring rain for 4 hours. I mean, it was a steady rainstorm for 4 hours, right? And never once did I have anyone complain. They were fine. And typically, the buses were more frequent than every 10 minutes. But the fact that they knew it was coming frequently, the fact that it was not this, well, the bus is going to be here at this time, really lended to the fact that they were a lot more relaxed. And that's what we're kind of hoping for with this connector route, if that makes sense. Okay. So this is really kind of what we talked with in the budget workshops about, and I think this is what Glenn was looking for, and if I don't address it, Glenn, please talk to me. But this idea of phase two, and this is, you know, really kind of what we're going to be doing over 2020, maybe into 2021, but it's this idea of really working with the CMPO, again, the Cache Valley, or the Cache Metropolitan Planning Organization. So that's all the cities from Wellsville to Smithfield, it's really working with them, with the county and those individual cities, in rethinking the whole system. So everything else now we can rethink it based on this connector route. And so this connector route allows these multiple connection points. So now all of a sudden, if you think about it, if I'm coming from Nibley, currently that route's an hour long to make that loop, you know, and I got to go all the way back to the transit center. Well, now all of a sudden, because we can connect it on the south, maybe that route now becomes a half an hour. And maybe we can run the buses, maybe we can put double buses on there, so now it's every 15-minute frequency. It's a half-hour route with 15-minute frequency. And maybe I don't want to go into Logan, I just want to stay and shop at Macy's or Walmart on the south end. I'm not forced to go into Logan, right? And so my trip becomes much shorter. And it's the same type of thing for Millville, Hiram, that type of thing. So now we're giving people options. Now, if I want to go into Logan, maybe I need to go to the university. I can still make that connection. That frequency is 15 minutes during the peak. I get dropped off. There's no expectation of a time transfer. You know, people aren't on the bus going, are we going to make it? Are we going to make transfers? Because that's what they're currently doing. There's no expectation there. And if they have, you know, an app, one of the few apps that we have out there, then they can look and see where the bus is. And maybe at these transfer points, we may even put up some signage that's also updated in real time. There's digital signs out there. These are things that we're going to be rethinking as we go through this year, that maybe right at that transfer point where we have some shelters, there might be digital signage. So it just changes the game. And again, I'm not saying that's what it is. I'm just saying that's a concept. Really what it is us working with these cities and saying, okay, what are your transit needs? How do we help you deliver on those transit needs? And what are your long-term transportation plans? How does transit fit into those long-term transportation plans? And so it really allows us to partner with them and have a different conversation. I think I covered all of those things. Questions on that? Does that make sense? I
like it a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
I think we're lucky because this covers a vast majority of destinations. I think we're lucky in Cache Valley that the majority of destinations are in a route like this.
Yeah. You know, I think you're right, Sean. One thing that really lends to our success with this is our topography. The fact that everything's on this north-south corridor is really nice. And I'd like to sit up here and tell you we're all transit geniuses. And again, the people behind me really are. They do phenomenal things. But the topography really does lend to this. You know, I go to Pocatello occasionally, and I just feel for them. It's just spread out everywhere. And that's really tough. But I will say, that is one of the challenges that we face as our communities sprawl. That is going to be harder and harder for us to serve everybody the way that they want to be served. Because, again, if you're hitting every little nook and cranny, that's going to slow the route down, and it may serve more people, but it's serving them at a slower pace. So phase three, then, is the other part of this. And again, that's the connector. We've just zoomed back now and looking kind of at the valley. Phase three is really maybe beyond 2020. It's really working again with the MPO. The MPO board has already funded a transit corridor study. So what we're looking at here is identifying future corridors that don't yet have a building maybe on them, or it's limited building. Identifying these corridors in these communities where we can really talk about land use planning that supports transit, you know, and maybe it's mixed use, and we can get out in front of the development and say, okay, this is the kind of land use we want in our city. This is how transit would interact in that type of land use, and we can make that plan. And then to the point of, if you look at Farmington Station down in Farmington, one of the things that really makes that successful is when they put the rails down, the developers know those rails aren't going to leave. That's a huge investment. With rubber tires, it's a little bit, well, we could change the street tomorrow, you know. And so what we're looking for, and Jeff Gilbert with the MPO, and this is part of what he talked with the board about, is we're really looking at trying to find cities that will identify long-term corridors, and the cities will say, this is a corridor we're committing to for transit. We're going to develop land use that's supportive of transit. And then the transit district, we're saying, yeah, we're committed to that corridor as well. We'll put an express bus, or we'll do something that's a little bit higher intensity, and then that will encourage the development, which then encourages economic growth and things of that nature. And we have something more that similar, not on the scale of Farmington Station, but more like that. Excuse me. And we've seen that down even with the UVX that runs from UVU to BYU, those types of things. And that's rubber tires. So again, this is phase three. This is a kind of a longer term thing, but to the point that MPO has really already got funding set aside. We've worked with them to really kind of do these two phases of planning with the cities and with the transit district. So that's where this connector really is, not just for January. This is really kind of a pivot to where we think the valley needs to go in the future. Questions? That makes sense? Okay.
Anything? Okay, we'll move on to item A, presentation of the fiscal year 2020 draft budget. Curtis?
It was hard to get in there, guys.
Great. First of all, thanks to everyone that's reached out in all sorts of manners, whether you came to a budget workshop or other means to reach out and give input on the budget, to understand a little bit more, appreciate all the input that we've received, and feel like it was productive, so thank you very much. What we've done is we've created a budget packet here. We started off, we introduced goals and key objectives previously. So I'm going to focus mostly on this page, which is going to be the key points, and then there's some breakout
page. Page 13 in the packet.
Yeah, page 13. And then also page 11 is going to, I'm just going to highlight some of the key assumptions, the key facts that we put into this. So very first thing we always monitor, if you go about 5/6 of the way down that page 13, you're going to see a line that's bold that says operating revenues less expenses. Everybody see that line? That's a critical one for us. So if you go into the 2020 proposed budget, you're going to see the $6,000 amount there. So this is key. Our operating revenues are projected to exceed our operating revenues. And so we know that there's still gonna be a couple of adjustments. We've still got some fine tuning to this budget. But this is a line we're always monitoring. We really, really don't want that to flip negative, because we wanna have enough money coming in to cover operating style to cover our operating expenses. Then just down below that, you'll see that we are planning some capital grants for $211,000. Capital expenditures, and that leaves us dipping into our savings for capital items in the net terms of about $235,000 under this plan. So that's how much of our savings, which remember we have over $5 million set aside for that. So we're not using but a little bit of that, a very minor amount. But that is where the primary source of the funding for our capital this year is going to be coming from. So what do these numbers really consist of? If we come back through some of the detail, one of the key factors is always sales tax. What are we projecting? How are we working? So far for the year, we've been running at about a 4% year-over-year increase. We're anticipating that will continue to the end of the year. We're not seeing a lot of change. We're not projecting a lot of change in that. However, for the next year, we are projecting revenues to be flat. And so right now, with this current projection, barring any changes, we're just keeping the revenues flat. Now, that's a pretty conservative approach. But what it does is it gives us some room that if sales tax actually happened to come in higher, well, that gives some more money to the board that if we needed a budget for something, we'd be able to. But right now, we don't have an increase in the sales tax. What we do have is on the additional sales tax, that started to flow in. So I started doing some initial projections. Right now, we're projecting to be a little bit over 200,000 to the end of the year. Based off of that, and once again, keeping sales tax flat for the next year, we think that's going to come in somewhere north of 400,000, you know, 435-ish. Projection based off of what we've seen the county projection, based off of what we've seen the county collect over the last year, how our ratios are. So there's some analysis in there. It's not a guess. It's a calculation. But there is some variability to that. Federal grants, you'll notice that's going up fairly substantially. We're anticipating eventually having more federal funds, but right now we've typically carried over about $1.2 million in federal grants that we've actually been awarded but haven't allocated out and obligated. And we kind of like to keep it at that 1.2 range, over 1 million, because then if something happened and sales tax went down or something significantly changed, it gives us time to wind down and not just immediately cut service. We'd be able to do some notices. So this takes our carryover balance to about $1 million is where that leaves it. So we're drawing down into that a little bit, but not to an extreme. So there's still enough where we'd wind down.
So is there a separate sheet on your capital fund balance?
Of what it is?
Besides what's here?
Yeah. So if you go to the next, it's the next page. There's a breakout for charges for service, professional fees, and then capital projects. And I'll go through that. It's the one right before.
Page 12.
Right at the bottom.
It's just before.
There. So I'll go through that. Other than that, the other major increase that you're going to see is in salaries and benefits. The salaries is the key part of this. $160,000-ish is what we're allocating for salaries and wages to run the new connector route, the boomerang, whatever we want to call it. So that's how much of the overall cost of the program is coming from salaries and benefits. So that's for all the drivers that it takes. It is anticipating one additional supervisor position because we're going to be expanding fairly substantially. We've got a lot of training that's going to be taken away. So it does include one extra position as well as the driver positions that are going to be needed.
How many FTEs totally are you anticipating?
Let's see, it's 10 plus 1, so 11. Mm-hmm. And then in conjunction with that, we're asking the board to authorize us to increase driver wages as of the first of the year by 50 cents per hour. This would be across the board, so this would affect all the drivers. We'd adjust their wage scale. We're struggling being competitive. We just went through this last round. Our applicant pool was smaller than we wanted it to be. We've got to be a little bit more competitive, and so we're asking for that type of increase. Also, in conjunction with this, we're asking for a cost of living pool to be allocated to employees for based off their position. So this would be merit employees, so evaluated positions. We're asking for a cost of living for them of $30,000, and then a merit pay pool of $37,000 that would then be allocated to employees based off of their performance. And all said and told, that equates to approximately 4%. But it's going to be allocated differently because certain positions are going to earn more merit, and other positions are not going to have a cost of living adjustment because their position isn't increasing in the market. While some positions are actually having a cost of living that's a little bit more substantial, just because that position is a little bit more desired in the marketplace. But so we're asking for pools in those amounts. And then also, just as by way of introduction, our health insurance came in at 3.7% increase, which we felt was absolutely wonderful. And what we're proposing is that there'd be no change to the employees for their benefit package, that we keep everything constant. with what we've been currently doing. And that, and the budget here reflects that, so we think there's adequate funding for it. So that covers salaries and benefits. After that, we've identified for you professional fees, different areas. So you'll see with public outreach and education, we're actually proposing an increase from $200,000 to $250,000. That's gonna bring in $50,000 more to help with the education and outreach programs related to the new connector route, trying to make the public totally aware of what it is, how it functions. Once again, we'd be working to do a variety of outreach type targets, whether that be social media, radio, TV. Pandora seems to be a big hit. We're getting a lot of traction through the internet, some of those services. So we've outlined all of the professional fees area that consists in that line. After that, it's kind of pretty small adjustments. We went through a lot more detail with the budget committees and went through it. They presented a number of questions. We tried to reflect that information as we were presenting. But at this point, I'm gonna stop. I'm gonna do like what Tim did and just say, what questions can we answer? Is there concerns,
so
ideas?
Curtis, do you know the difference? Can you tell me the ratio between salaries and benefits? You've got those on one line. I didn't know percentage to salaries.
Yeah, on average, it averages about 42% is the benefit ratio. Is about where it averages out.
Would you remind me, on the public outreach and community engagement, does most of that, will Rumor be handling most of that?
The line item for public outreach and community engagement that's, we're proposing $40,000, that's actually our own internal budget. So this is where we're gonna be doing different efforts where we'll take and make up t-shirts and hand them out as part of things. Pens, the little flashlights that people like that, we give them a lot to passengers when it's dark. Those seem to go pretty good. So it's those types of things. We're actually picking up on that side of things to incorporate the new connector route as well. And that's why there's some increase there.
Okay,
but that's not the Rumor contract.
Okay.
That's the Rumor contract comes back more to the $250 that's in professional fees.
Great.
Does that contract expire in August of this year?
It actually runs for the entire calendar. It runs for the calendar year, so it runs based off of the budget. So when Rumor presented, they presented that it was a kind of a three-year overall plan. And so this would be the second year of that three-year funding. But it is contingent upon the board's authorization to continue it.
So that will be what will happen in like next year. It seems like we said after a year or so of looking at this, we want to see if we're getting any bang for the buck.
Yeah, and at any point in time, we can bring them in and talk to them about what sort of statistics we've been able to hit. I know I can tell you our web traffic is up exponentially over what it was previously.
I was just gonna say, should we bring them in for November?
Probably not. I mean, it seems like it hasn't been a full year since they proposed it, and we wanted to give time to see how things work. Right? That wouldn't be enough time.
When was it? Do you remember?
Actually, they came to this October meeting, if I remember right, last year, and they presented then as to their plan. So that it was in, because it was in anticipation of it was before the budget meetings.
The only reason I'm saying that, Sean, is, again, we're proposing to continue that, and so if you want to have conversation with them before you approve or not approve something in the budget, it might be helpful to have them come in and talk to the board and give some accountability to that.
Hey, Todd, would it be appropriate to have them, if when we look at the transit route and the changes from an educational standpoint, would it be a good thing to have them maybe look at that and then incorporate that in whatever it is they're planning on doing the next?
Yeah,
we already had that discussion.
Yeah, so we're already in the process of having that discussion with them. I think it is an important part of that, yeah.
Because that'll be an adjustment for the public to understand.
Mm-hmm. It is, and that's one reason, like Curtis said, why we're proposing to increase this a little bit, because we do think there's some differences, some mindset changes in how people would view that route compared to how they viewed the system. And we really want to make sure that the public outreach and education is there so that we can make that transition as easy as possible for people and do it in an effective way.
So in answer to your question, like, yeah, it's happening right now. We're working with them, but I think it'd be good to present to the board.
It's a great point,
yeah. So that they can explain exactly what we've given input about what we think is needed for the community.
So I have a couple other questions. In operation salary and benefits, you know, with the...
Can I just remind you to speak into your microphones?
Sorry.
That's all right.
You know, with this $842,000 increase, and it's explained really well on the page before, but our projected year to end is going to be several hundred thousand less than the 2019 budget. So where this year was down quite a bit, what's the reason for basing this increase on the projected year, rather than the actual budget of 2019?
Yeah, we had to take a completely different approach when we built this budget up.
Okay.
And remember, when we start our budget process, we zero everything out. So we start from zero. And so what we did is we took and analyzed every single route and every single change that we're doing, put in the actual hours that we expected would have to be included. Mm-hmm. And the one factor that constantly comes into these is what happens if we have turnover or we have drivers that are more experienced that leave and then we replace them with younger drivers, or you know, how does that really impact us? And there's not a really good way to anticipate that somebody's gonna leave. And so every year we anticipate that there probably will be some savings.
Still budget based on the last budget, not on the end, because you can't.
Well, it's not like we take last year's budget and just add a percentage or anything to it. We're actually building this up from scratch and saying, how much is it gonna really take to operate this? Now, some things that cause a little bit of variance is, it depends on when certain merit pay increases were awarded last year. Some of those are still even waiting to be awarded,
yeah,
based off of performance. And so there's some nuances there as to how things play out. But the number that we've built up is based off of what we think it will really take to run this system.
Okay. So like for salaries, that if you look over the percentage increase, you know, the 21.59%,
yeah,
that's over last year's proposed budget. But if we actually use the projected year to end, that's more like, what, a 33% increase? It's a much larger increase.
And most of that, like I say, is adding on these new people and the new positions that it takes to add on.
Still there's some.
It is a substantial increase, but we're also adding a substantial amount of service.
I'm trying to think how many hours that's.
Curtis, does that include the connector route increases for that?
Yeah, this includes everything
that
it takes to run
right.
that area. And so that's what's causing the substantial portion of those increases.
Okay.
So
and then
the question, sorry, Sean.
No, go ahead.
The question Sean was asking, I kind of had the same question, but what you're saying is, in order to change the system and go to this, it's really an increase of about $1.2 million. Well, maybe not quite.
Not quite that, but
is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, it's not an $842,000 increase. It's well over a million.
Yeah, that's what we're saying is, this is a million-dollar addition. When we first came, we said this is going to cost $1 million, and between salaries and benefits and everything like that, yeah, that's what it's running.
So with only a $435,000 tax increase each year and no projected, or additional, and then no projected change in sales tax, can we afford this in the long run?
Well, that's why it's important to notice that we're projecting our operating revenues are exceeding our operating expenses. So we've built it to where, yes, we can function this way.
For this year?
For 2020.
Yeah.
Now, once again, if sales tax happens to go up 1%,
right,
that's going to bring in an additional $50,000 to $55,000 of revenue. So if we happen to go up 4%, now you're talking about $200,000 to $250,000 that we would actually be even better off, because we're budgeting very pessimistically. And on the expense side, we're budgeting fairly liberally to make sure we've got enough man hours in here to actually provide the service. So we're, if anything, we might be overstating expenses, but we will not. We've typically shown in the past that we won't even spend all of that budget.
Right.
And
this projected year to end versus the 2019 budget shows that you get in many areas.
Consistently, we've been around that area. So. We're just trying to put forth our best guess of what it takes to run this, and some of it's worst case scenario. I mean, if it's running with fairly expensive drivers, it's running with.
Part of this too is to that point. We're a little heavy because again, it's a transition. It's a mindset. We don't want to. Start this route and understaff it, you know, meaning we don't want to understaff the support and all of that. We want to make sure we're out there, we're addressing people's concerns, challenges, because they're going to happen even with all of these apps and all of that. I mean, we're going to have people that are going to have some frustration, and we expect that, but we want to make sure we can address that with them, that we have staff sufficient to do that, and then also staff sufficient to support our drivers, so that they don't get overwhelmed when people are frustrated, that they feel supported. I think Curtis said it correctly. We're probably a little bit heavy, but again, it's what we think based on our research.
But even heavy, I mean, it looks like we can't afford this route in the long term without dipping into the savings every year. Sorry, I call it savings. I know that's offensive.
The stick funding's the other part of that that we talked about
that
before.
That might increase.
And we've scheduled where that one's a pretty math. That the ones that we're hitting is a mathematical calculation. So we're projecting we're going to hit it.
Okay, and that's not in this budget anywhere.
It's not totally reflected. Like I said, we're drawing down our federal grants a little bit more with the stick funding. If it comes in the way that we said, we'd actually have even more federal funds that could come in. And so there's a number of factors here that we could take and make this look a lot better. I mean, all I got to do is throw a 2% increase in on sales tax, and all of a sudden we've got $100,000 variance.
Yeah.
We can anticipate that we'll have even more federal funds and throw another $100,000 in, and I've got a $250,000 variance.
Yeah, it's just something to think about, maybe to see how it goes this year.
It is. Yeah. And so what we've almost presented to you a pessimistic worst case scenario.
Yeah, I agree. Very conservative.
Saying that. We're not trying to overstate the expenditures, but we're saying this is what we think it takes to run the system. But then we're also pulling back on the revenues and saying we're hopeful that it's a lot better than this, but we think it will be, but we're not going to project that.
Okay. Then my last question regarding that is, with the new boomerang, we are budgeting for lower fuel costs, less fuel?
Overall to last year, so... It's a combination of things. We actually have more fuel that's delivered, but we're decreasing the actual cost per gallon. This last year we budgeted $3 per gallon. It's hovered more down around $2.25, and so we're budgeting $2.50 in this current year, and that makes a huge difference.
But this budget does include the purchase of more fuel.
It does include all the. Okay. It does include. We ran the mileage out, ran it against our miles per bus, and made the calculation, and our gallons is usually a pretty solid estimate. The price is always the big variable. So it's right now we've got it at $2.50. So lately it's been hovering right around $2.30, $2.25, $2.30. And so that's the one where there's a possibility that something went geopolitical. I mean, if the Middle East explodes, that price will go up. But so far, even with all this stuff this year, we haven't seen it go over $2.50.
How often do you buy it, like quarterly
so
or something?
Right now we're buying about every 10 days.
Oh, to fill it.
Fill the tank.
Oh, okay. I thought it was more solar, sorry.
No, it's about every 10 days. We're anticipating that's probably going to drop down to about every 7 days. Good question.
Any other questions?
Good questions.
No. You're still going to go into the benefit package, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll cover that a little bit more. So just reiterating on capital projects, we've got it in that we'll be replacing two of our paratransit buses. A support vehicle, portable lifts in the shop. We've currently got one set of portable lifts. We're asking for two just because it's going to make the maintenance be able to go that much faster, especially where we're expanding the fleet just a little bit. We are not going to get the paratransit software purchase done this year. The project, just writing the RFP ended up taking us about two, almost 3 months more than what we anticipated as we got into it. So we do have it ready to, we'll have it ready to award before the November meeting, and we'll have this cost finalized, but it's coming in right close to $100,000, depending on the options that we take. We'll have that narrowed down, but we're close on that estimate right there. And so that's one of the budget variances from this last year that we're just gonna carry over. And so really it's already in fund balance, if you look at it that way. Those are the major purchases that are going on. So questions on the budget? We're not asking for a vote tonight. Our plan is, by law, we have to adopt a tentative budget next month and then have a budget hearing. That's where it'll be open up to the public in December, and then have to have a vote before the end of the year, preferably at the December meeting, but it has to happen before the end of the year.
And just to encourage again, if you have other questions or concerns that you want, please let us know, and even for board meeting, let us know, and then we can make sure we address them in the board meeting.
Todd, I have to excuse myself. I have to go be a candidate.
Sorry. Well, good luck with that.
Thanks.
So with that rumor, if our November meeting is not too jam-packed, maybe it would be good to have an accountability.
Okay. Do that.
I think it would be nice to see, as you were discussing, what their preliminary thoughts may be for this expansion, so the public has greater awareness of what's going on.
Okay.
Anything else for Curtis on this?
No, I don't need to pass a resolution to move forward with the benefits.
Yeah, so, but are you going to cover more of that?
Yeah, so I'm going to open it up. I didn't really prepare a ton for benefits just because we're not proposing any changes to the benefit package from last year. But we do have so we currently use PHP for our health insurance. That's Public Employers Health Plan. We have two different networks that people can choose from. One's an IHC-based network. The other one's more based off of Mountain Star. They call it their Summit Plan. And so the employees have a choice of either one of those networks. So that's which doctors and hospitals you can see. And just by way of reminder, we offer both a high deductible plan that's a $4,000 deductible for a family, $8,000 out of pocket. Or they offer, if the employee pays part of the premium, they can do a traditional insurance plan, which is a $500 deductible per person, $1,000 deductible per family, with a $4,000 per person out of pocket or $8,000 family out of pocket. So that's the basics of the health insurance plan that we offer.
And then CBTD pays for that. If they choose the high deductible, they pay every employee $2,000 a year.
It can only go into the HSA. It's not a payment to the person. It's just a contribution to the HSA.
If they do the one with the 500 deductible, then that.
They don't get anything, and they have to pay a portion of the premium.
They do, but they don't have to pay the full deductible, right? Or do they?
No, they have to pay the full deductible, yeah.
And they still pay a portion of the premium.
And they pay a portion of the premium.
What's the employee percentage that they pay?
We don't do it percentage-wise, so the high deductible plan is 100% employee paid. For the employee side, it turns into, it's $100 per month that they pay for the traditional if they're on the family plan. It's $50 per paycheck. Yeah, I know it's at least $100 for the family. For a single, it's not as much.
That's for traditional, but
that's for traditional.
For HSA, you don't have any participation.
For the high deductible, yeah. No, the employees, that one's offered to the employees completely.
We structure it so that they're about mirrored in the value of what is covered as far as the premium. I mean,
doesn't the traditional still cost you more?
Yeah.
Are you trying to encourage people off of the traditional?
The traditional has more of a cost, and so that we pass that along to the employees, so that they have to pay for that extra premium. Our benefit package is a little bit tilted because our wages are lower, And so the total compensation is what we use when we're comparing a lot across the market. And so, yeah, the benefit package is just a little bit higher because we found that's what keeps our employees here. It's not the wage that keeps people around. Every time they're leaving, they hate giving up the benefits.
But the wage is still important. I really do want to emphasize it's the total compensation. It's not an either or. And so I just want to make sure that we clarify that with everyone.
You still have a tiered benefit package system?
As far when it comes to retirement, yes. There's an additional retirement for anybody who's a salary employee. So there's an additional percentage that's contributed into the retirement plan. That we're keeping the same.
Does the two questions? Does the money that goes to pay for those who choose the high deductible, does that come out of salaries and benefits portion in the budget? So the part of the CBTD where they pay like $2,000 a year for those who are,
yeah, that's that all in the benefits.
That's in my and that's part of that 42%.
That's part of the benefit package.
And then for does retirement also come out of the benefit package?
Yes.
And the executive retirement, the extra 11% also comes out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's all included in there.
Any other questions for Curtis?
I'll move the benefit package as presented.
Okay, I have a motion that the benefit package, employee package, be adopted by Patrick Jenkins. Do I have a second?
Sir.
I have a second from Roger Jones. Are there any questions? Any more discussion? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And it's unanimous. Okay, we'll move on to item number 10. Consider adoption of the board policy manual.
Yep. Ollie, Roger, you're leaving just in the nick of time for the good stuff.
I'm sorry.
And you thought you could get away without hearing about policy governance again. My goodness. I do want to publicly recognize everybody on the Public Engagement Policy Committee. We have Cecilia Benson, Leeren Hansen, Gregory Shannon, Sue Sorensen, Jeff Turley, myself, and then Craig Wright is the board representative. All of us have worked diligently to develop this form that you have in your packet, okay? This is one page of 33, okay? We, over the past couple of years, we have approved all of the interpretations by the general manager. And now comes the time for the monitoring. We first thought we were gonna monitor, we were gonna do each individual one, which would require 11 different assessments. And then through some discussion and shaking of fists and pointing fingers and going through things, we combined all of the forms that we've each have developed and created this one form that you see in front of you. It will have the policy, and the one that you have is the first policy, which is treatment of riders, the policy number, the general manager's interpretation. We will then turn this 33-page document, electronically that is, to Holly, which will then transfer it to Todd, or the general manager, and the blue section is what Todd will fill in for each policy. He will provide the policy deliverable, the evidence, the specific reference within the evidence, and any notes that he wants the reviewers to understand or his opinion. And then the reviewers, which is the PEP committee, and any of you who wish to join us that aren't on the PEP committee, we'd love to have you. We expect this to be returned to us by the general manager on the first Monday in January. And then the month of January, the PEP committee, and again, anybody who wishes to join us, we will then begin our review, which we will then go through the documents and everything that Todd has given us, where he's showing evidence that he has effectively implemented his interpretation. And we will go through that in January. We'll break up in teams. We'll look at all 10 policies, and then we will come together as a committee, and we will come up with a consensus of our reviewer notes and our reviewer's conclusion. And from that, we will develop an executive summary and submit that to the board chair, which will then present that to the board. This has been a long process in going. As a result of this review monitoring issue, the way we've done it is that we've developed a new Appendix A, which will go into the policy manual. And if you look at this sheet here, this is our history of changes. The items in black are the ones that we have already approved as a board. As we've done each policy, we've made changes to the policy. We have each approved all of those policies. Now, what we've done since then is there are simple things. We renumbered policy, the UNS policy. We've eliminated the original Appendix A, B, and C, and we've replaced them with the new Appendix A. And then in the process of doing this, the committee actually did do a full-blown review of the UNS policy. And as a result of that, we've made one change to what Todd has given us in his interpretation, of which was he was giving us the list of documents that he was using. And we've decided as a committee and at his request to remove those documents from the policy because they will change over time. And so what we've done is by removing them, we have given him a greater freedom to bring any additional documents to support his interpretation, which we will review as part of the monitoring process. Lloyd, you look concerned.
No, I'm not concerned. I have a question. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So why do we do this? let me tell you why I'm asking, as part of
the policy governance, we have gone through and Todd has given us his interpretation. We now need to validate that he has actually implemented and doing what he says he's doing.
And I understand that part. I'm just saying, is this part of an accreditation process, or is there some thing
that says this is how? It's part of the policy governance process.
How did we get this tool?
How did we get this tool?
Yeah.
Todd, how did we get this tool?
You guys have been the ones working.
So it's not part of some overall.
When we did this, we started this about 3 years ago.
Okay. I'm just.
And
just
we started this about 3 years ago because it gives the. It. How can I put this? I've read so much on it, I get confused sometimes, and I do apologize on that. Is that it develops a methodology on how the board will behave and act, and then how we interact with the board. In other words, the board is separate from CBTD. If you look at it this way, there's two inverted triangles, you know, or points of two pyramids. The point of contact between the two is the board chair and the CEO or the general manager. The board has its own policies that it follows. That's chapter 3 and 4 of the policy manual. We've developed the playing field that Todd operates under, which is chapter 1 and chapter 2. And what he's done is if you look at the policy manual, it's written in a negative format, which we've told him what he can't do. So he's telling us in this operating field how he's going to operate. We've given him that freedom to operate. Now he's telling us how he's going to do that. That's his interpretation of the policy. So now we're going back and saying, okay, you've given us your interpretation. Now that you've told me, show me. So he's going to give us the evidence that says, yes, I'm doing what I'm saying that I'm doing. And we're going to come back and say, okay, now we're going to go through all of these documents. We're going to review everything that you've given us. And we're going to look at it and say, yeah, you are, or, well, you know, no, you're not. And so we will be looking at that. This also can act as a performance evaluation. It will actually not act as, it will contribute to his annual performance. And so by him saying, Life for Treatment of Riders, his interpretation is the district has formal training and procedures that outline clearly the appropriate standards of conduct when working with the public. Those procedures also outline action the district may take if an employee's action does not meet the appropriate standard of conduct. So he's taking, we're saying, okay, now, you tell us what the deliverable is, you show me the evidence that this is actually in place and actually taking place. And then we're gonna sit there and he's gonna tell us in the third column here under objective evidence where that evidence is, and then any notes that he might say, explanatory notes. And then when we sit down, the board, the PEP committee will sit down and go through these documents. We'll look up his specific references and we'll look at other references too. Just because he's told us it's in document A, paragraph 3, doesn't mean that's all we're looking at. We might go to document A and look at paragraph 3, and knowing me, I might read the whole chapter, I might read the whole document. Some of us will dive and dig, and others might skim, and it's how each one of us do things. So that when we're done, we'll be able to say, Todd is doing what he's told us he's gonna do.
So it's a pretty complex framework for just saying, Todd, you're doing what you're supposed to do. But I'm just, so when we go through this, was there a time when we had an unruly board and we needed to put something together that formalized the board's the legislative branch, the chair's probably his administrative person, I guess, and we work through the chair, is that correct? That's kind of what I heard you say with the triangle thing.
Well, we actually haven't even looked at chapter 3 yet.
Oh, okay.
See, chapter 3, each of us has the policy manual. You've been given the policy manual.
Yeah.
Okay, my question is, let me ask you, have you read it?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Well, no, that's not true. I've looked for things.
Okay, but when you look at it, what we've focused on is what we've required Todd to do.
Yeah.
Now we're gonna start looking at, in January, we're gonna start looking at how we operate as a board. And that will get into our conduct, how we treat each other, how we act as one voice, all this stuff, and it will help us become better at what we do. Or at least I think it will be. I mean, I'm the only one that's got a library of books on this stuff that I could read.
I'm just trying to understand.
Can I make a comment? I thought the same thing when we started this, but as we have delved deeper and have gotten more into it, I think it's another independent level of accountability to the taxpayer. They are the ones that are basically funding this, and I think for us to be able to say we did this independent review and that his interpretation has... that he has performed at that level that he said that he would. In my mind, it just kind of settled that I can tell those that ask, that there are these reviews that are done. So.
Yeah, and Todd, I do think you're right that this probably did start partially as a result of an unruly board. It's trying to get lay people that are working on a board to work directly with an individual point of contact, Todd, and put the responsibility on him to run his organization. It's a really complicated system. But the idea then is to make Todd totally responsible for operations and the facility, and he tells us, we've told him what to do, he tells us what he's doing, and then we review it to make sure it's being done.
And I commend the board members for the amount of time that you guys are putting into this. That's certainly...
we've been working on this once a month, all year.
But does it, when the board, and I appreciate what you just said, I think if I'm looking at it, and I remember when we first sat down, I thought, okay, I'm looking at his interpretation of this rule, and that's what I'm evaluating. I'm not evaluating the rule, because that was made clear to me. I'm evaluating his interpretation. Okay, fine. But does the board have the ability to say, Todd, what happened on the bus the other day when this one guy got out of control, and how did the bus driver handle that situation, and how can we make sure that we're handling that in the public correctly and so forth? Is that not our role?
You can bring that to the board. Just make sure it gets on the agenda.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I just am trying to see.
As we get into Chapter 3, you'll see how that information gets to the meeting and gets on the agenda, and we can talk about those things.
Okay. Okay, well,
Patrick, you had a question.
Is the action considered tonight, you're just looking for adoption of this path?
Yes.
So moved.
Okay, we got it. Thank you.
We'll vote. Okay, I have a motion.
That was quick.
From Patrick Jensen. Jenkins, sorry.
Doesn't matter. he wants to get this thing over with.
Yeah, to adopt the board policy manuals. Do I have a second?
No, Jeff.
Jeff.
I have a second from Jeff Turley. Thank you. Are there any other discussions? Patrick saying no. Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Do you dare? That's unanimous.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I don't have anything for board chair report. Todd. And Todd has nothing. So we will adjourn and see you November 20th. Thank you for all your help.